6. There was a lot of activity in the bowl. Chief Chong Wan's tribe of Chinese had, for the most part, been replaced in Edinburgh by the North Chinese Johnny had sent there from Russia. The returning people were smudged and singed. Some were in a state of obvious exhaustion that not even rest on the flight from Edinburgh had eased. They rushed gladly to their children, scooping them up, embracing them, throwing questions to the older children. The dogs were straining at their leashes and barking joyously. It was a scene of glad reunion. Johnny was glad he had gotten them replaced on the rescue team. They had worked without ceasing, and soon would have been unable to carry on. Yet they had worked until they nearly dropped. Watching fathers in happy chattering exchange with their youngsters, watching mothers anxiously verifying whether this or that had been done properly, as to feeding and naps, Johnny thought of those disdainful and arrogant lords and the soulless haughtiness of government. What did they care what happened to people like these? Yes, such governments might go through gestures of justice and perhaps even social work, but they remained cold, hard forces that could disrupt and shatter lives and people without conscience, without a second thought. Chief Chong Wan was getting them organized. He told Johnny as he rushed by that he was moving them all to the old mine site dome that had been cleaned up. It had rooms underground, and the armor cable was working there now. Well, Johnny was free of the signing conference. Dunnell Dean was available to take over. In ops, he asked Dunnell Dean, "Any news from Edinburgh come in with this tribe?" Dunnell Dean shook his head. Johnny grabbed an air mask and flight jacket. "Then I'm off to find Stormalong." He got no further than the exit to the bowl. He collided head-on with Stormalong himself.
"Where have you been?" cried Johnny. "I have called and called and called."
Stormalong pushed him into a bunker where they could not be overheard.
"I have been fighting and flying my goggles off for days."
He looked it. He was gaunt and hollow of eye. His white scarf was dirty, his jacket stained with sweat and grease. He even had a gun burn in his shoulder.
"You're hurt," said Johnny.
"No, no, it's nothing. A Drawken officer wouldn't surrender. I had to chase him with a marine attack plane.
Imagine it, him on foot running up the side of a mountain, Ben Lomond, and me having to stun him, not kill him, just stun him, mind you, with a blast cannon. And then when I landed and got out, he was just playing dead and he shot me, and I had to stun him again with a handgun. Oh, laddie, it has been a wild time."
"What have you been doing?" demanded Johnny, making no sense of it.
"Catching prisoners. They left marines and pilots scattered around the Singapore site, some wounded, some not. They didn't bother to pick up their wounded in Russia. Dunnell Dean must have shot down 30 enemy planes around Edinburgh, and pilots that ejected are scattered to the west and in the Highlands. It takes some doing, let me tell you, to pick them up. They think they'll be tortured or sprinkled with virus or killed, and they don't surrender easily."
"All by yourself?"
"Except for half a dozen bank guards. And they're French, Johnny. They're not soldiers. They can maybe guard a vault or carry valuables.
Stormalong, I had radios in all those places. You must have had your set on. People must have seen you." None of it made any sense to Johnny.
"It's McAdam, Johnny. He wouldn't let me answer. And anybody we saw, he told them they mustn't put on the air they'd seen us. I told him you would be worried, but he said no, no. Radio silence utterly and absolutely. I am sorry, Johnny."
With careful patience, Johnny said, "Begin at the beginning. Did you deliver the copies of the talk I had with the small gray men?" Stormalong sank down on an ammunition box. He verified they were out of sight and hearing of everyone.
"I got there about dawn and went right to McAdam's bedroom, and when he heard I was from you, he put the whole thing on a projector. Then he called the German and grabbed 6 bank guards and a whole basket load of galactic banknotes, and he told a girl in his office not to give out any information at all, and we got airborne. He just plain kidnapped me. We've been to every battleground looking for officers. He had a list of nationalities, and he wanted several of each. Johnny, those French bank guards are no help. I had to do all the flying and fighting. But I did get some rest, every time we'd collect some officers. Did you know both he and the German speak excellent Cyclo? I was surprised they'd been studying so hard. They'd interrogate them, and I'd get a couple of hours of catnap. Then we'd load the prisoners aboard, all tied up. The bank guards could sit there with a gun on them, and off we'd go to another location. What was he asking them? Oh, I don't know. He didn't use torture. Sometimes he handed out a fistful of galactic banknotes. They talked.
Johnny looked out the bunker entrance at the plane. There were the bank guards, all right. They were dressed in gray uniforms. But they weren't pushing prisoners. They were unloading boxes, and some Chinese were bringing up some mine carts and rushing loads into the bowl.
I don't see any prisoners, said Johnny.
Oh, well, said Stormalong, we came back to Luxembourg and picked up some boxes, and he got a couple more bank guards, Germans this time, and we flew down to the Victoria mine site. I got a pretty good rest there because he spent so much time talking to the captives we already had there. Then we dumped out prisoners and came on, and here we are. And that's the whole thing.
It was a long way from the whole thing, Johnny thought. He told Stormalong to go get some food and rest, and went out to find the banker. Mick Adam, short and stocky, his black beard flecked with gray, was pointing this way and that and rushing people along. He stopped abruptly when he saw Johnny and shook his hand vigorously. Then he turned and beckoned another man to come over.
"I don't believe you ever met Baron von Roth," said McAdam, "the other member of the Earth Planetary Bank."
The German was a huge man, as tall as Johnny and heavier. He was bluff and hearty, red of face.
"Ach, but I am pleased," he bellowed and promptly gave Johnny a huge hug.
McAdam had vanished into the bowl, and the German picked up a heavy box and rushed after him. Johnny knew something of the German. Although he had made a fortune in dairy and other foodstuffs, he was descended from a family that was supposed to have controlled European banking for centuries before the Cyclo invasion. He looked like a very tough, capable man. The last of the baggage from the Marine attack plane was being wheeled into the entrance. Johnny couldn't figure out what they were up to. Inside, a crew of Chinese and some bank guards under the direction of Chang Wan were hanging huge mine tarpaulins all around the pagoda eaves to completely hide the firing platform itself. Some more Chinese were stringing mine cables and hanging tarps on them to make a covered passage from a bunker to the console. They were totally hiding the platform and all operation of it. McAdam was talking with Angus, and although they smiled at him when Johnny came up, McAdam was very rushed, and he said, "Later, later." All the baggage had vanished into the covered bunker. The Chinese children and dogs were all gone. Some Chinese were cleaning the bowl up. Some emissaries wandered out and watched what was happening with the tarpaulins, and then, showing little curiosity, wandered off, showing each other bits and points in the brochure. Donald Dean was on the job in the ops room and told Johnny that he'd talked Stormalong into getting his beard trimmed like Sir Francis Drake. No, nothing new from Edinburgh, except that the North Chinese now working there were doing fine. Did Johnny know they were much bigger men? Oh, yes, and Kerr and two bank guards were holding blast rifles on 50 new prisoners at Victoria. Johnny glanced up at the sky. If worse came to worst, he had his own way to handle this. A way which might make a fatal future, but which might have to be done. He went to his room to get into less spectacular clothes. They had a few short days, but days had a habit of passing awfully fast when you needed them. The final confrontation, the last battle, was all too near.
7. The fateful moment of the bank meeting arrived. 5 days had passed. Johnny sat alone in the small meeting room that had been prepared and waited for the others to arrive. There was not the slightest doubt in his mind that this was going to be a battle bigger than he had ever fought before. Being Johnny, he had been unwilling to simply sit idly by while McAdam and Baron von Roth prepared. They had been busy enough,
For 5 days and nights, the hum of the teleportation rig had resounded through the bowl. Things had come and things had gone on the platform behind the tarpaulins. But they did no talking, lest they be overheard, and the only words that sounded were, "Motors off! No planes approaching! Stand by!" and "Fire!" Whenever anyone, especially emissaries or the small gray men, had come near the tarpaulins or the curtained corridor to a bunker, stern bank guards had pushed them back peremptorily. All Johnny got from McAdam was, "Later, later." Not even Angus was talking. He had gotten an estimate that it would be several days. Mr. Tsung had told Johnny that the negotiations of finance and banking were very specialized things. He had added one phrase that had stuck in Johnny's mind. "The power of money and gold over the souls of men passes all wondering." The pre-dawn sky of the day after McAdam's arrival had found Johnny in the air. He had heard of a university outside the ruins of an old city named Salisbury, about 175 miles southeast of Kariba. He had tried to get Sir Robert to come along, but the old Scot was hanging on to the radio in the ops room, doing what he could for Edinburgh. Instead, Johnny had taken a couple of Chinese soldiers to shoo off the lions and elephants when they threatened to interrupt his studies. The university was a ruin, but the library could be sorted out amid the dust and debris, the roof and walls having stood. Camped out in the wreckage, Johnny had pried congealed packs of catalog cards apart and had pretty well found what he was looking for. It had been a well-endowed library once. It included lots of economics texts, probably because the relatively new nation had had a dreadful economic struggle of it. The texts were in English, and they covered the history of economics and banking pretty well. Mr. Tsung had been absolutely right. It was a highly specialized subject. And when one went wrong, like some nut named Keynes they had all become mad at, it really messed things up. What Johnny got out of it was that the state was for people. He had suspected that was the way it should be. And individuals worked and made things and exchanged them for other things. And it was easier to do it with money. But money itself could be manipulated. The Chinkos had been great and patient teachers, and Johnny knew how to study. And with a mind like his, he got things as quickly as a traveling shot. 4 of those 5 days had been spent ears deep in books, nose full of dust, with Chinese guards warning off black mamba snakes and African buffalo. Sitting there in the meeting room waiting for the others, he had the satisfaction of knowing that, while he was no expert, he would at least have a grip on what this battle was all about. Sir Robert came in, grumbling and cross, and took a seat over to the side with Johnny. Even though the small gray men had indicated it was between Sir Robert and them, the War Chief of Scotland knew that Claymore's and Lochaber axes weren't going to win this one, and as far as he was concerned, it was all up to the experts. Basically, he was very concerned about Edinburgh. They had gotten food and water through into the various shelters with thin hoses, but rock was still crumbling in on their tunnel efforts. They had been driving in huge, heavy pipe casings for days now, and the only hope was that they were not crumbling this time. Dries Glotton and Lord Voraz came in. A table for 4 had been set in the middle of the room, and they took 2 of the places on one side of it. They were very neatly dressed in gray suits. They had their arms full of papers and attaché cases, and they put them down. They looked exactly like hungry sharks. Neither Johnny nor Sir Robert had acknowledged their arrival. "You don't seem very pleased this morning," said Lord Voraz. "We be men of the sword," said Sir Robert. "We have small truck with the money changers of the temple." Sir Robert's sudden use of English caused both small gray men to turn on their vocoders. "I noticed," said Dries Glotton, "when I came in, that there were 50 soldiers in white tunics and red pants all around in the rifle pits in the bowl."
"An honor guard," said Sir Robert.
"They had an assortment of weapons," said Dries, and one huge fellow certainly looked more like a brigand than an officer in charge of an honor guard.
"I wouldn't let Colonel Ivan hear you say that," said Sir Robert.
"Do you realize," said Dries Glotten, "that if you killed the emissaries and us, you would become an outlaw nation? They know where we are. You would have a dozen fleets in here smashing you to bits."
"Better to fight fleets than be all cut up with bits of paper," said Sir Robert, gesturing at their piles of it. "There's no threat in the Russians if you tell the truth and behave."